for them, I repeat. She forces a laugh.
What is with these questions, Sage? All of a sudden you're writing a book?
In response, I turn her arm over and gently push up the sleeve of her blouse so that the blurry edge of her blue tattoo is exposed. I'm not the only one in the family with a scar, Nana, I murmur. She pulls away from me and yanks down the cotton.
I do not wish to talk about it.
Nana, I say, I'm not a little girl anymore.
No,
she says abruptly. I want to tell her about Joseph. I want to ask her about the SS soldiers she knew. But I also know that I won't. Not because my grandma doesn't want to discuss it, but because I am ashamed that this man I've befriended, cooked for, sat with, laughed with, might have once been someone who terrified her.
When I got here to America, this is when my life began, my grandmother says. Everything before, well, that happened to a different person.
If my grandmother could reinvent herself, why not Joseph Weber? How do you do it? I ask softly, and I'm no longer asking just about her and Joseph, but about myself as well. How do you get up every morning and not remember?
I never said I do not remember, my grandmother corrects. I said I prefer to forget.
Suddenly, she smiles, cutting the ribbon between this conversation and whatever comes next.
Now, my beautiful granddaughter did not come all this way to talk about ancient history, did she? Tell me about the bakery.
I let the beautiful comment slide. I baked a loaf of bread that had Jesus's face in it, I announce. It's the first thing to come to mind.
Really?
My grandmother laughs.
Says who?
People who believe that God might show up in an artisan bull, I guess. She purses her lips.
There was a time when I could see God in a single crumb.
I realize she is extending an olive branch, a sliver of her past. I sit very still, waiting to see if she'll go on.
You know, that was what we missed most. Not our beds, not our homes, not even our mothers. We would talk about food. Roast potatoes and briskets, pierogi, babka. What I would have given my life for back then was some of my father's challah, fresh from the oven.
So this is why my grandmother bakes 4 loaves every week when she cannot finish even one herself. Not because she plans to eat it, but because she wants to have the luxury of giving the rest away to those who are still hungry. When my cell phone begins to ring, I grimace. It's probably Mary, giving me hell because Rabina's arrived to start the night's baking instead of me. But as I pull it out of my pocket, I realize that the number is unfamiliar.
This is Detective Vix, calling for Sage Singer.
Wow, I say, recognizing the voice. I wasn't expecting you to call me back.
I did a little digging,
he replies.
We still can't help you, but if you want to take your complaint somewhere, I'd suggest the FBI.
The FBI. It seems like a massive step up from the local police department. The FBI is the organization that captured John Dillinger and the Rosenbergs. They found the fingerprint that incriminated the murderer of Martin Luther King Jr. Their cases are high-profile matters of immediate national security, not ones that have languished for decades. They will probably laugh me off the phone before I finish my explanation. I look up and see my grandmother at the kitchen counter now, wrapping one of the challah loaves in tinfoil. What's the number? I ask. It's a miracle that I make it back to Westerbrook without driving off the road. That's how tired I am. I let myself into the bakery with my set of keys and find Rabina asleep, sitting on a giant sack of flour with her cheek pressed to the wooden countertop. On the bright side, though, there are loaves on the cooling racks and the smell of something baking in the oven. "Rabina," I say, gently shaking her awake. "I'm back." She sits up.
"Sage, I just dozed off for a minute."
"It's okay. Thanks for helping me out." I slip into an apron and tie it around my waist. "How was Mary on a scale of 1 to 10?
"About a 12. She got pretty worked up because she's expecting a lot of traffic tomorrow thanks to the Jesus loaf."
"Hallelujah," I say flatly. I tried the number of the local FBI office while driving home, only to be told that the section I really needed to talk to was part of the Department of Justice in Washington, D.C. They gave me a different number, but apparently the Human Rights and Special Prosecutions section keeps bankers' hours. I got a voice recording telling me to call another number if this was an emergency. It is hard to justify this as an emergency, given the length of time that Joseph had kept his secret to himself. So instead, I have decided to finish up the baking, load the loaves into the glass cases, and be gone before Mary arrives to open the shop. I'll call back from the privacy of my own home. Rabina walks me through the timers that she's set around the kitchen, some measuring bake time, some measuring dough that's proofing, some measuring shaped loaves left to rest. When I feel like I'm up to speed, I walk her to the front door, thank her, and lock up behind her. Immediately, my gaze falls on the Jesus loaf. In retrospect, I won't be able to tell Mary why I did it. The bread is stale, hard as stone, with the variegations of seed and pigment that created the face already fading away. I take the peel I use to slide bread in and out of the wood-fired oven and toss the Jesus loaf into the yawning maw of the kiln, onto the red-hot flames in its belly. Rabina has made baguettes and rolls. There are a variety of other breads to be finished before dawn. But instead of mixing according to my usual schedule, I alter the day's menu. Doing the calculations in my head, I measure out the honey, the water, the yeast, the sugar, the salt, and the flour. I close my eyes and breathe in the sweet wheat. I imagine a shop with a bell over the window that rings when a customer enters, the sound of coins dropping like a scale of musical notes into the cash register, which might make a girl look up from the book in which her nose is buried. For the rest of the night, I bake only one recipe, so that by the time the sun simmers on the horizon, the shelves of our daily bread are packed tightly with the knots and coils of my great-grandfather's challah, so much that you could never imagine how hunger might feel.
I kept dozing off in the market. I hadn't slept since I buried my father, not with any of the bells and whistles and fanfare he had joked of, but in a small plot behind the cottage. My insomnia was not born of grief, however, it was out of necessity. I had no money for taxes. We had no savings, and our only income came from the market where we sold our daily loaves. In the past, my father baked while I trekked into the village square, but now there was only me. I found myself living around the clock. At night, I would roll up my sleeves and shape mounds of dough into boule. I would mix more while those rose. I would take the last loaves out of the brick oven as the sun spilled, like an accident, over the horizon in the morning. Then I would fill my basket and hike to the market, where I found myself struggling to stay awake while I hawked my wares. I didn't know how long I could continue this. But I wasn't going to let Baruch Beiler take away the only thing I had left, my father's home and his business. However, fewer customers were coming into town. It was too dangerous. My father's body had been one of three found this week around the outskirts of the village, including a toddler who had wandered into the woods and had never returned. All had been disfigured and devoured the same way, as if by a ravenous animal. Frightened, the townspeople were opting to live off their own gardens and canned goods. Yesterday, I had seen only a dozen customers. Today, there had been only six. Even some of the merchants had chosen to stay safe behind their locked doors. The market was a gray, ghostly space, the wind whistling over the cobblestones like a warning. I opened my eyes to find Damien shaking me awake.
"Dreaming of me, darling?" he asked.
He reached past me, brushing my face and ripped the neck from a baguette. He popped the bread into his mouth.
You're nearly the baker your father was.
For just a moment, compassion transformed his features.
I'm sorry about your loss, Anya.
Other customers had told me the same. Thank you, I murmured.
I, on the other hand, am not, Baruch Beiler announced, coming to stand behind the captain. Since it greatly diminishes my chances of ever receiving his tax revenue.
It's not the end of the week yet, I said, panicking. Where would I go if he turned me out into the streets? I had seen women who sold themselves, who haunted the alleys of the village like shadows and who were dead in the eyes. I could accept Damien's offer of marriage, but that was just a different kind of deal with the devil. Then again, if I were homeless, how long would it be before the beast that was preying upon the people of our village found me? From the corner of my eye, I saw someone approaching. It was the new man in town, leading his brother on the leather leash. He walked past me without even glancing at the bread and stood in front of the empty wooden plank where the butcher usually set up his wares. When he turned to me, I felt as if a fire had been kindled beneath my ribs.
"Where is the butcher?" he asked.
"He isn't selling today," I murmured. I realized he was younger than I'd first thought, perhaps just a few years older than me. His eyes were the most impossible color I had ever seen, gold but gleaming as if they were lit from within. His skin was flushed with bright spots of color on his cheeks. His brown hair fell unevenly over his brow. He was wearing only that white shirt, the one that had been beneath the coat he traded the last time he'd been in the village square. I wondered what he'd been willing to barter with today. He didn't say anything, just narrowed his eyes as he stared at me.
"The merchants are running scared," Baruch Beiler said, "just like everyone else in this godforsaken town." "Not all of us have iron gates to keep the animals out," answered Damien.
"Or in," I murmured beneath my breath, but Beiler heard me.
10 zloty, he hissed, "by Friday."
Damien reached into his military jacket and pulled out a leather pouch. He counted the silver coins into his palm and flung them at Beiler.
"Consider the debt paid," he said.
Beiler knelt, collecting the money. Then he stood and shrugged.
"Until next month."
He stalked toward his mansion, locking the gates behind himself before vanishing into the massive stone house. From their position in front of the empty meat stall, I could see the man and his brother watching us.
"Well?"
Damien looked at me.
"Didn't your father teach you any manners?"
"Thank you."
"Perhaps you'd like to show your appreciation," he said. "Your debt to Beiler's paid, but now you owe one to me."
Swallowing, I came up on my tiptoes and kissed his cheek. He grabbed my hand and pressed it against his crotch. When I tried to push away from him, he ground his mouth against mine.
"You know I could take what I want any time," he said softly,
his hands bracketing my head and squeezing my temples so hard that I couldn't think, could barely listen.
"I'm only offering you a choice out of the goodness of my heart."
One minute he was there, and the next he wasn't. I fell, the cobblestones cold against my legs, as the man with the golden eyes yanked Damien away from me and wrestled him to the ground.
"She already chose," he gritted out, punctuating his words with blows to the captain's face.
As I scrambled away from their fight, the boy in the leather mask stared at me. I think we both realized at the same time that his leash was dangling, free. The boy threw back his head and started to run, his footsteps echoing like gunshots as he raced across the deserted village square. His brother paused, distracted. It was enough of a hesitation for Damien to land a solid punch, The man's head snapped back, but he staggered to his feet and chased after the boy.
"You can run," Damien said, wiping the blood from his mouth. "But you can't hide."
Leo. The woman on the phone is breathless.
"I've been trying to find you for years," she says.
"This is my first red flag. We're not that hard to find. You ring up the Justice Department and mention why you're calling, you'll be routed to the Office of Human Rights and Special Prosecutions. But we take every call, and we take them seriously." So I ask the woman her name.
"Miranda Kunz," she says. "Except that's my married name. My maiden name was Schultz."
"So, Miss Kunz," I say, "I can hardly hear you."
"I have to whisper," she says. "He's listening. He always manages to come into the room when I start trying to tell people who he really is."
As she goes on, I wait to hear the word Nazi or even World War II. We're the division that prosecutes cases against people who have committed human rights violations, genocides, torture, war crimes. We're the real Nazi hunters. Nowhere near as glamorous as we're made out to be in film and television. I'm not Daniel Craig or Vin Diesel or Eric Bana, just plain old Leo Stein. I don't pack a pistol. My weapon of choice is a historian named Ginevra who speaks 7 languages and never fails to point out when I need a haircut or when my tie doesn't match my shirt. I work in a job that gets harder and harder to do every day as the generation that perpetrated the crimes of the Holocaust dies out. For 15 minutes, I listen to Miranda Kunz explain how someone in her own household is stalking her and how at first she thought the FBI had sent him as a drone to kill her. This is red flag number 2. First of all, the FBI doesn't go around killing people. Second, if they did want to kill her, she'd already be dead. "You know, Miss Kunz," I say when she breaks to take a breath, "I'm not sure that you've got the right department."
"If you bear with me," she promises, "it will all make sense."
Not for the first time, I wonder how a guy like me, 37, top of his class at Harvard Law, turned down a sure partnership and a dizzying salary at a Boston law firm for a government pay grade and a career as the deputy chief of HRSP. In a parallel universe, I would be trying white-collar criminals instead of building a case around a former SS guard who died just before we were able to extradite him. Or, for that matter, talking to Miss Kunz. Then again, it didn't take me long in the world of corporate law to realize that truth is an afterthought in court. In fact, truth is an afterthought in most trials. But there were 6 million people who were lied to during World War II, and somebody owes them the truth.
"And you've heard of Joseph Mengele?"
At that, my ears perk up. Of course I've heard of Mengele, the infamous angel of death at Auschwitz-Birkenau, the chief medical officer who experimented on humans and who met incoming prisoners and directed them either to the right, to work, or to the left, the gas chambers. Although historically we know that Mengele could not have met every transport, almost every Auschwitz survivor with whom I've spoken insists it was Mengele who met his or her transport, no matter what hour of the day the arrival took place. It's an example of how much has been written about Auschwitz, how survivors sometimes conflate those accounts with their own personal experiences. I have no doubt in my mind they truly believe it was Mengele they saw when they first arrived at Auschwitz, but no matter how much of a monster the guy was, he had to sleep sometime. Which means that other monsters met some of them instead.
"People believe Mengele escaped to South America," Miss Kunz says.
I stifle a sigh. Actually, I know that he lived and died in Brazil.
"He's alive," she whispers. "He's been reincarnated in the form of my cat, and I can't turn my back on him or go to sleep because I think he's going to kill me."
"Good God," I mutter.
"I know,"
Miss Kunz agrees.
"I thought I was getting a sweet little tabby from the shelter, and one morning I wake up to find scratch marks bleeding on my chest."
"With all due respect, Miss Kunz, it's a little bit of a stretch to think that Joseph Mengele is now a cat.
Those scratch marks, she says gravely, were in the shape of a swastika.
I close my eyes. Maybe you just need a different pet, I suggest.
I had a goldfish. I had to flush it down the toilet.
I am almost afraid to ask. Why? She hesitates.
Let's just say, I have proof that Hitler was reincarnated too.
I manage to get her off the phone by telling her that I'll have a historian look into her case. And it's true. I will pass this off to Ginevra the next time she does something to piss me off and I want to get back at her. But no sooner do I have Miranda Kuntz off my line than my secretary buzzes me again. Is your moon out of alignment or something? She asks. Because I've got another one for you on line two. Her local FBI office referred her here. I look at the piles of documents on my desk, reports that Ginevra has turned in. Getting a suspect to trial is a slow and laborious expedition, and in my case, often a fruitless one. The last case we were able to bring to prosecution was in 2008, and the defendant died at the end of the trial. We do the opposite of what police do. Instead of looking at a crime and seeing who done it, we start with the name and pour through databases to see if there's a match, a person who's alive with that name, and then to figure out what he did during the war. We have no shortage of names. I pick up the receiver again. This is Leo Stein, I say. A woman replies.
I'm not sure I have the right place.
I'll let you know if you tell me what you're calling about.
Someone I know may have been an SS officer.
In our office, we have a category for these calls. My neighbor is a Nazi. Typically, it's the neighbor from hell who kicks your dog when he crosses the property line and calls the town when the leaves of your oak tree fall in his yard. He's got a European accent and wears a long leather coat and has a German shepherd. And your name is?
Sage Singer, the woman says. I live in New Hampshire and so does he.
This makes me sit up a little straighter. New Hampshire is a great place to hide if you're a Nazi. No one ever thinks to look in New Hampshire. What's this individual's name, I ask?
Joseph Weber.
And you think he was an SS officer because...
He told me so, the woman says.
I lean back in my chair. He told you that he was a Nazi? In the decade I've been doing this, that's a new one for me. My job has involved peeling away the disguises from criminals who think that after nearly 70 years they should literally get away with murder. I've never had a defendant confess until I've managed to back him so far into a corner with evidence that he has no choice but to tell the truth.
We're acquaintances, Sage Singer replies. He wants me to help him die.
Like Jack Kevorkian? Is he terminally ill?
No. He's the opposite. Very healthy for a man his age. He thinks that there's some sort of justice in asking me to be a part of it, because my family was Jewish.
Are you?
Does it matter?
No, it doesn't. I'm Jewish, but half the staff in our department isn't. Did he mention which camp he was in?
He used a German word. Toten... Odin something?
Totenkopfverbände, I suggest.
Yes.
Translated, it means the death's head unit. It's not an individual location, but rather the division of the SS that ran the concentration camps for the Third Reich. In 1981, my office won a seminal case, Fedorenko versus United States. The Supreme Court decided, wisely in my humble opinion, that anyone who was a guard at a Nazi concentration camp necessarily took part in perpetration of Nazi crimes of persecution there. The camps operated as chains of functions, and for it to work, everyone in the chain had to perform his function. If one person didn't, the apparatus of extermination would grind to a halt. So really, no matter what this particular guy did or didn't do, whether he actually pulled a trigger or loaded the Zyklon B gas into one of the chambers, even confirming his role as a member of the SSTV in a concentration camp would be enough to build a case against him. Of course, that's still an enormous long shot. What's his name? I ask.
Joseph Weber.
I ask her to spell it, and then I write it down on a pad, underline it twice. Did he say anything else?
He showed me a picture of himself. He was wearing a uniform.
What did it look like?
An SS uniform, she says.
And you know this because...
Well, she admits, it looks like the ones you always see in movies.
There are two caveats here. I do not know Sage Singer. She could be a recent escapee from a mental hospital who is making this entire story up. I also do not know Joseph Weber, who himself might be a mental hospital escapee seeking attention. Plus, there's the fact that I've never in a decade received a cold call like this from an ordinary citizen about a Nazi in the backyard that actually panned out. Most of the tips we go on to investigate come from lawyers representing women in divorce suits, hoping to allege that their husbands, who are a certain age and from Europe, are also Nazi war criminals. Imagine the payout, if you can get a judge to believe how cruel the guy was to your client. And always, even these allegations turn out to be total crap. Do you have that photo? I ask.
No, she admits. He does.
Of course. I rub my forehead. I've gotta ask, does he have a German Shepherd?
Dachshund, she says.
That would have been my second choice, I murmur. Look, how long have you known Joseph Weber?
About a month. He started coming to a grief therapy group I've been going to since my mother died.
I'm sorry to hear that, I say automatically, but I can tell it is a kindness she isn't expecting. So, it's not as if you really have a thorough understanding of his character, or why he might say he did something he didn't actually do.
God, what is it with you people? She explodes. First the cops, then the FBI. Shouldn't you at least be giving me the benefit of the doubt? How do you know he's not telling the truth?
Because it doesn't make sense, Miss Singer. Why would anyone who's managed to hide for over half a century just suddenly drop the pretense?
I don't know, she says frankly. Guilt? A fear of Judgment Day? Or maybe he's just tired of living a lie, you know?
When she says that, she hooks me. Because it's so damn human. The biggest mistake people make when they think about Nazi war criminals is to assume they were always monsters. Before, during, and after the war. They weren't. They were once ordinary men with fully operational consciences who made bad choices and had to fabricate excuses to themselves for the rest of their lives when they returned to a mundane existence. Japonev's birth date? I ask.
I know he's in his 90s.
Well, I tell her, we can try to check his name and see if we get a hit. The records we have aren't complete, but we've got one of the best databases in the world with over 30 years of archival research in it.
And then what?
Assuming we get confirmation, or for some other reason think there might be a legitimate claim, I'd ask you to talk to my chief historian, Ginevra Astonopoulos. She would be able to ask you a host of questions that would help us investigate further. But I have to warn you, Miss Singer, even though my office has received thousands of calls from members of the public, none have panned out. In fact, there was one call prior to this office's creation in 1979 that led the U.S. Attorney's Office in Chicago to prosecute the alleged criminal, who turned out not only to be innocent, but a victim of the Nazis. Out of all the tips we've received since then from citizens, not a single one has actually become a prosecutable case. Sage Singer is quiet for a moment.
Then I'd say you're due for one, she says.
All things considered, Michel Thomas was one of the lucky ones. A Jewish concentration camp inmate, he escaped the Nazis and joined the French Resistance, and then a commando group before assisting the U.S. Army Counterintelligence Corps. During the last week of World War II, he received a tip about a truck convoy near Munich, believed to be carrying some sort of important cargo. Arriving in a paper mill warehouse in Freimann, Germany, he discovered heaps of documents that the Nazis had planned to have pulped. The worldwide membership file cards of over 10 million members of the Nazi Party. These documents were used at the Nuremberg trials and afterward to identify, locate, and prosecute war criminals. They're the first stop for the historians who work with me at HRSP. That's not to say that if we don't turn up a hit on a name, that individual wasn't a Nazi. but it does make building a case a hell of a lot easier. I find Ginevra at her desk. I need you to run a name, I say. After Germany was unified in the 90s, the United States returned the Berlin Document Center, the central repository of SS Nazi Party records that had been seized by the U.S. Army after World War II, but not before microfilming the whole damn thing. Between the Berlin Document Center and the information that came to light after the breakup of the USSR, I know Ginevra is bound to unearth something. That is, if there's something to be unearthed. She looks up at me.
You spilled coffee on your tie,
she says, pulling a pencil out of the bird's nest of frizzy yellow hair piled on top of her head.
Better change it before your date.
How do you know I have a date? I ask.
Because your mother called me this morning and told me I should push you out the door with brute force if you were still here at 6:30 p.m.
This doesn't surprise me. No cable, Ethernet, or Fios system is as blisteringly fast at spreading news as a Jewish family. Remind me to kill her, I tell Ginevra.
Can't, she muses. Don't want to be roped in as an accomplice.
She grins at me over her glasses.
Besides, Leo, your mom's a breath of fresh air. All day long I read about people who craved world domination and racial superiority. By comparison, wanting grandchildren is sort of sweet.
She has grandchildren. Three, courtesy of my sister.
She doesn't like the fact that you're married to your job.
She didn't much like it when I was married to Diana, either, I say. It's been 5 years since my divorce was final, and I have to admit, the worst thing about that whole experience was having to admit to my mother that she was right. The woman I believed to be the girl of my dreams was not, in fact, right for me. Recently I ran into Diana in the metro. She's remarried, and she's got one kid and another on the way. We were exchanging pleasantries when my cell phone rang. My sister asking me if I was going to be able to make it to my nephew's birthday party that weekend. She heard me say goodbye to Diana, and within the hour, my mother had called to set me up on a blind date. Like I said, Jewish Family Network. I need you to run a name, I repeat. Ginevra takes the paper from my hand.
It's 6:36, she says. Don't make me call your mother.
I stop back at my desk to grab my briefcase and laptop, because leaving without them would be as foreign to me as leaving without my arm or leg. I instinctively reach for the holster on my belt to make sure my BlackBerry's there. I sit down for a second and Google Sage Singer's name. I use search engines all the time, of course. Mostly it's to see if someone, Miranda Coots, for example, is a complete whack job. But the reason I want to find information on Sage Singer is her voice. It's smoky. It sounds like the first night of fall when you build a fire in the fireplace and drink a glass of port and fall asleep with a dog on your lap. Not that I have a dog or port, but you get what I mean. This, if nothing else, is proof that I ought to be running out the door to go on that blind date. Sage Singer's voice may have sounded young, but she's probably in her dotage. She did say, after all, that this Joseph Weber guy was a friend of hers. Her mother had recently died, after all, probably of old age. And that husky rasp could be the mark of a lifelong cigarette addict. The only Sage Singer in New Hampshire who pops up, though, is a baker at a small boutique cafe. Her berry tart recipe is in a local magazine as part of a summer cornucopia piece. Her name appears in the business listing of the newspaper heralding the opening of Mary DeAngelis's new bakery. I click on the news link and find a video from a local television station, one uploaded just yesterday. Sage Singer, the reporter says in a voiceover, is the baker who crafted the Jesus loaf. The what? The clip is an amateur video of a woman with a messy ponytail, her face turned away from the camera. I can see a mark of flour on her cheek the moment before she completely ducks out of the spotlight. She isn't what I expected. When ordinary citizens call HRSP, it usually tells you more about them than about the people they're accusing. They want a conflict resolved. They hold a grudge. They want attention. But my gut tells me that's not the case here. Perhaps Ginevra will turn up a hit after all. If Sage Singer can surprise me once, maybe she can do it again. My car has, I am sure, the world's last 8-track cartridge player. As I sit in traffic on the Beltway, I listen to Bread in Chicago. I like to pretend that everyone in all the cars around me is listening to 8 tracks too, that the years have been rolled back to a simpler time. I realize how strange this is, given how much smaller the world has become as a result of technology and how my office has benefited from it. Even better, having an 8-track player isn't just strange anymore, it's retro. I'm thinking of this, and whether I should tell my blind date that I'm so tragically hip I buy my music on eBay instead of iTunes. The last time I went out, a colleague who set me up with his wife's cousin, I spent the whole dinner talking about the Alexandros Lilakis case, and the woman begged a headache before dessert and took the metro home. The truth is, I'm lousy with small talk. I can discuss the fine points of the Darfur genocide, but the majority of Americans probably can't even tell you the country where that's taking place. It's Sudan, FYI. On the other hand, I can't talk football or tell you the plot of the last novel I read. I don't know who's dating whom in Hollywood, and I don't really care. There's so many things in the world considerably more important. I check the name of the restaurant against the note in my BlackBerry calendar and walk inside. I can tell it's one of those places where they serve precious food. Appetizers the size of a mushroom cap, unpronounceable ingredients listed for each menu item that make you wonder if someone sits around making these up. Cod semen and wild fennel pollen, beef cheeks, meringue grits, ash vinaigrette. When I give the maitre d' my name, he leads me to a table in the rear of the dining room. A place so dark I wonder if I'll even be able to tell if my date is attractive. She's already seated, and as my eyes adjust to the lack of light, I notice that, yes, she's cute, except for her hair. It's styled with a big poof on the top, as if she's trying to fashionably mask encephalitis.
"You must be Leo," she says, smiling. "I'm Irene."
She's wearing a lot of silver jewelry, much of it caught in her cleavage. "Brooklyn, I guess."
"No," she repeats more slowly. "Irene." "No, I mean, your accent.
Are you from Brooklyn?"
"Jersey," Irene says. "Newark."
"The car theft capital of the world. Did you know more cars are stolen there in L.A. and NYC put together?" She laughs. That sounds like a wheeze.
"And my mother's worried about me living in Prince George County."
A waiter comes over to rattle off the specials and to take our drink order. I order wine, about which I know nothing. I choose one based on the fact that it's not the most expensive one on the list, and it's not the least expensive either, because that would just look cheap.
"So this is weird, huh?" she says.
Either she's winking at me or she has something in her eye.
"Our parents knowing each other?"
The way it's been explained to me, my mother's podiatrist is the brother of Irene's father. It's not like they grew up next door.
"Weird," I agree. "I moved here for a job, so I don't really know anyone yet."
"It's a great city," I say automatically, although I don't entirely believe this. The traffic is insane, and there's a protest every other day about some cause, which quickly stops being idealistic and starts being a pain in the neck when you need to get somewhere in a timely fashion and all the roads are blocked off. "I'm sure my mom told me, but I've forgotten. What do you do?"
"I'm a certified bra fitter," Irene says. "I'm working at Nordstrom."
"Certified," I repeat. I wonder where the legitimizing agency for bra fitters is. If you get grades, A, B, C, D, and double D. It sounds like a very unique job.
"It's a handful," Irene says, and then she laughs. "Get it?"
Yeah.
"I'm doing bra fitting now so I can put myself through school and do what I really want."
"Mammography?" I guess.
"No. Be a court reporter. They're always so stylish in the movies."
She smiles at me.
"I know what you do. My mother told me. It's very Humphrey Bogart."
"Not so much. Our department isn't Casablanca, just the poor bastard stepchild of the DOJ. We don't actually have Paris. We barely even have a coffee maker." She blinks. "Never mind."
"So how many Nazis have you caught?"
"Well, it's a little complicated," I say. "We've won court cases against 107 Nazi criminals. 67 have been removed from the U.S. to date. But it's not 67 out of 107 because not all of them were U.S. citizens. You have to be careful about the math. Unfortunately, few of the people we've deported or have had extradited were ever prosecuted, to which I say shame on Europe. Three defendants have been tried in Germany, one in Yugoslavia, and one in the USSR. Of those, three were convicted, one was acquitted, and one had his trial suspended for medical reasons and died before it could continue. Before our department was created, one other Nazi criminal was sent from the U.S. to Europe and prosecuted there. She was convicted and imprisoned. We've got five cases currently in litigation and many more people under active investigation, and your eyes are glazing over.
No, Irene says. I just wear contacts. Really? She hesitates. But aren't the guys you're chasing, like, really old now?
Yes.
So they can't be moving all that fast.
It's not a literal chase, I explain.
And they did horrible things to other human beings. That shouldn't go unpunished.
Yeah, but it was so long ago.
It's still important, I tell her.
You mean because you're Jewish?
The Nazis didn't just target Jews. They also killed gypsies and Poles and homosexuals and the mentally and physically disabled. Everyone should be invested in what my department does, because if we're not, what message is America sending to people who commit genocide? That they can get away with it if enough time passes? That they can hide inside our borders without even a slap on the wrist? We routinely deport hundreds of thousands of illegal aliens every year whose sole offense is that they overstayed a visa or came without the right paperwork. But people who are involved in crimes against humanity get to stay? And die peacefully here? And be buried on American soil?
I don't realize how loud and impassioned I've become until a man who is sitting at the next table starts to clap, slowly but forcefully. A few other folks at tables around me join in. Mortified, I sink lower in my chair, trying to become invisible. Irene reaches for my hand and threads her fingers through mine.
It's okay, Leo. Actually, I think it's really sexy.
What is?
The way you can wave your voice around like it's a flag.
I shake my head. I'm not some big patriot. I'm a guy who's doing his job. I'm just tired of defending what I do. It isn't obsolete.
Well, it is, kind of. I mean, it's not like those Nazis are hiding in plain sight.
It takes a moment for me to realize she is confusing the words obsolete and obscure. At the same time, I think about Joseph Weber. According to Sage Singer, has done just that for decades. The waiter arrives with the bottle of wine and pours a taste for me. I swish it around in my mouth, nod my approval. At this point, frankly, I'd have given the thumbs up to moonshine as long as there was a valid alcohol content.
I hope we're not going to talk about history all night, Irene says breezily, because I'm really bad at it. I mean, who really cares if Columbus discovered America instead of West Hampton?
The West Indies, I murmur.
Whatever. The natives were probably less bitchy.
I refill my wine glass and wonder whether I'll survive until dessert. Either my mother has a sixth sense, or else she implanted a microchip in me at birth that allows her to know my comings and goings at all times. It's the only way I can explain the fact that she times her phone calls for the very moment I walk in my front door without fail. Hi, Mom, I say, pushing the speakerphone button without even bothering to look at the caller ID.
Leo, would it have killed you to be nice to that poor girl?
That poor girl is completely capable of landing on her feet, and she doesn't need or want someone like me anyway.
You don't know if you're compatible after one lousy dinner, my mother says.
Mom, she thought the Bay of Pigs was a barbecue joint.
Not everyone had the educational opportunities you did, Leo.
You studied that stuff in 11th grade, I say. Besides, I was nice to her. There is a pause on the other end of the line.
Really? So you were being nice when you took a phone call and told her it was the office, and you had to go because John Dillinger had been captured?
In my defense, dinner had lasted 2 hours already, and our entree plates hadn't even been cleared.
Just because you're a lawyer doesn't mean you can twist the story around. I'm your mother, Leo. I could read your thoughts in utero.
Okay, A, that's creepy. And B, maybe you and Lucy should just let me find my own dates from now on.
Your sister and I want you to be happy. Is that such a crime?
She says.
Plus, if we waited for you to find your own dates, you'd be sending your wedding invitation to me at the Sons of Abraham.
It's the cemetery where my father is already buried. Great, I say. Just make sure you leave your forwarding address. I hold the keypad away from my ear and punch the pound button.
Got another call coming in,
I lie.
At this hour?
It's an escort service, I joke.
I don't like to keep Peaches waiting.
Ugh, you're gonna be the death of me, Leo, my mother says with a sigh. Sons of Abraham Cemetery, got it, I say. I love you, Ma.
I loved you first,
she replies.
So what am I supposed to tell my podiatrist about Irene?
If she keeps wearing heels, she'll wind up with bunions, I say, and hang up. My house is very GQ. The countertops are black granite, the couch is covered in some kind of gray flannel. The furniture is spare and modern. There's blue lighting under the cabinets in the kitchen that makes the place look like mission control at NASA. It looks like the kind of place where an NFL bachelor or a corporate attorney would be comfortable. My sister, Lucy, who does interior design, is responsible for the look. She did it to snap me out of my post-divorce funk, so I can't really tell her that it seems sterile to me. Like I'm an organism in a petri dish, not a guy who feels guilty putting his feet up on the lacquered black coffee table. I strip off my tie and unbutton my shirt, then carefully hang my suit up in the closet. Realization number one about single life. No one else is going to take your suits to the cleaners on your behalf. Which means if you leave them crumpled in a ball at the foot of the bed, and you work till 10 every night, you're screwed. Wearing my boxers and an undershirt, I put on the stereo. It's a Duke Ellington kind of night. And then find my laptop. Granted, it might have been more exciting if I had stayed in Boston working in corporate law. And who knows, maybe this decor would be just my cup of tea. I'd be out schmoozing with clients instead of reading Ginevra's report on one of our suspects right now. God knows I'd be socking away more money for retirement. Maybe I'd even have a girl named Peaches curled up at the end of the sofa. But in spite of what my mother thinks, I am happy. I cannot imagine doing anything except what I do and liking it more. I'd first gotten an internship with HRSP when it was still called OSI, the Office of Special Investigations. My grandfather, a World War II vet, had regaled me with stories of combat my whole life. As a boy, my most prized possession was an M35 Heer steel helmet that he gifted to me, with a dark spot on the inside he swore was brain matter. My mother, disgusted, removed it from my room one night while I was asleep, and to this day hasn't told me what she did with it. In college, hoping to pad my resume before I went to law school, I took the job at OSI. I expected legal experience I could put on my applications. What I got instead was passion. Everyone in that office was there because they wanted to be, because they truly believed that what they did was important. No matter what the Pat Buchanans of the world said about the U.S. government wasting money to hunt down people who were too old to be a threat to the general population. I went to Harvard Law and had my choice of offers from Boston firms when I graduated. The one I picked paid me enough to buy fancy suits and a sweet Mustang convertible, which I never had time to joyride in, because I was working furiously on a track toward becoming a junior partner. I had cash, I had a fiancé, and 95% of my litigations had resulted in a verdict for the defendant I was representing. But I missed caring. I wrote to the director of OSI and moved to Washington 1 month later. Yeah, I know that my head is more mired in the 1940s than the 2010s. And true, if you spend too much time living in the past, you never move forward. But then again, you can't tell me what I do isn't necessary. If history has a habit of repeating itself, doesn't someone have to stay behind to shout out a warning? If not me, then who? The Duke Ellington track ends. To fill the silence, I turn on the television. I watch Stephen Colbert for about 10 minutes, but he's too entertaining to be background noise for me. I keep finding myself pulled away from Ginevra's report to listen to his patter. When my laptop chimes with an incoming email, I look down at the screen. Ginevra.
Hope I'm not interrupting a lovely sexcapade with the next Mrs. Stein, but just in case you're sitting home alone watching old episodes of Rin Tin Tin like me, don't judge. Thought you'd want to know that Joseph Weber's name returned no hits. Onward and upward, boss. I stare at the email for a long moment.
I had told Sage Singer that the odds were against her. For whatever reason, Joseph Weber is lying to her about his past. But that's Sage Singer's problem now, not mine. I've questioned dozens of suspects over the years I've worked at HRSP. Even when I'm presenting some of them with the incontrovertible evidence that they were guards at an extermination camp, they always say that they had no idea that people were being killed. They insist that they only saw the prisoners on work detail, and they remember them being in good condition. They recall seeing smoke and hearing rumors of bodies being burned, but they never witnessed it themselves and didn't believe it at the time. Selective memory. That's what I call it. And, go figure, it's completely different from the stories of survivors I've interviewed, who can describe the stench from the chimneys of the crematoria. Nauseating and acrid and sulfurous, fatty and thick. Almost more of a taste than a smell. They say you couldn't help but breathe it in, everywhere you went. That even now, they sometimes wake up with the smell of burning flesh in their nostrils. Zebras don't change their stripes, and war criminals don't repent. It doesn't surprise me that Joseph Weber, who confessed to being a Nazi, isn't one. After all, it's what I expected. What surprises me is how much I really wanted Sage Singer to prove me wrong.
When you can prolong the inevitable, it's always better. That's why, for a predator, the wilding begins with a chase. It's not toying with food, as some people think. It's getting the adrenaline level to match your own. There comes a point, though, where waiting is no longer possible. You hear the prey's heart beating inside your own head, and it's the last conscious thought you'll be able to hold. Once you give in to the primeval, you're an observer, watching another part of you feast, shredding the flesh to find the ambrosia. You drink in the victim's fear, but it tastes like excitement. You have no past, no future, no sympathy, no soul. But you knew that before you even started, didn't you?
Sage. When I show up for work the next night, someone else is baking in my kitchen. He is a behemoth of a man, 6-foot-something, with Maori-style tattoos on his upper arms. When I walk in, he's cutting slabs of dough and tossing them with incredible precision onto a scale. "Hey," he says, in a squirrely voice that doesn't match his body. "How you doing?" My mind is a colander, and all the words I need to have this conversation are funneling fast through a sieve. I am so surprised I forget to hide my scar. "Who are you?"
"Clark."
"What are you doing?" He looks at the table, the wall, anywhere but at me.
"The dinner rolls."
"I don't think so," I say. "I work alone." Before Clark can respond, Mary enters the kitchen. She was no doubt alerted to my arrival by Rocco, who had greeted me in the front of the bakery with this cryptic observation. "Dreamed of traveling? Maybe take up knitting? Now may be the time."
"I see you've met Clark."
She smiles at the giant who is now shaping loaves at a blistering speed. I wonder if he's poked through my preferments and pored over my spreadsheets. It makes me feel as if someone has been rifling through my underwear drawer.
"Clark used to work at King Arthur Flour in Norwich, Vermont."
"Good. Then he can go back to them."
"Sage, Clark's just here to help you out, to relieve some of the stress."
I take Mary by the arm and turn her away so that Clark can't hear what I say. "Mary," I whisper, "I don't want any help."
"Maybe so," she says, "but you need it. Why don't you and I take a little walk?"
I'm fighting tears and the uncontrollable urge to throw a tantrum. I'm equal parts angry and hurt. Yes, I took the night off without telling my boss, but I found my own replacement. And maybe I changed the menu without running it by her either, but that challah I baked was moist and sweet and perfect. But mostly I'm upset because I thought Mary was my friend, not just my boss, which makes her zero-tolerance policy even more devastating. She leads me past the last few customers in the shop, who are being rung out by Rocco. As we pass the register, I turn away from him. Did Mary tell Rocco she was getting rid of me? Is he her new confidant about this business, the way I used to be? I follow her through the parking lot and the shrine gates, up the holy stairs, until we are standing in the same grotto where Joseph told me he was a Nazi. "Are you firing me?" I burst out. "Why would you think that?" "Oh, I don't know. Maybe because Mr. Clean's in my kitchen baking my dinner rolls? I can't believe you'd replace me with some drone from a factory." "King Arthur Flowers, hardly a factory, and Clark's not a replacement. He's just here to give you a little flexibility." Mary sits down on a granite bench. Her eyes are a piercing blue, with all that monkshood behind her. "I'm only trying to help, Sage. I don't know if it's stress or guilt or something else, but you're not yourself lately. You've become erratic." "I'm still doing my job. I've been doing my job," I protest. "You baked 220 loaves of challah last night." "Did you try any? Trust me, no customer could find a better one anywhere else." "But they would have to go somewhere else if they wanted rye bread, or sourdough, or any ordinary wheat loaf, or any of the other staples you chose not to make." Her voice grows soft as moss. "I know you were the one who got rid of the Jesus loaf, Sage. Oh, for God's sake, I prayed about it. That loaf was a call to save someone, and now I realize that person is you." "Is this because I played hooky?" I ask. "I had to see my grandmother. She wasn't feeling well." It is amazing, I realize, how quickly lies compound. They cover like a coat of paint, one on top of the other, until you cannot remember what color you started with. Maybe Joseph had actually begun to believe he was the person everyone thought him to be, and maybe that was what finally made him tell the truth. "Look at you, Sage, a million miles away. Are you even listening to me? You're a hot mess. Your hair looks like there are birds nesting in it. You probably haven't showered today. You have circles under your eyes that are so dark it makes me think of kidney failure. You're burning a candle at both ends, working here all night and then committing adultery during the day with that trollop." Mary frowns. "What's a male version of trollop?" "Shimbo," I say. "Look, I know you and I don't see eye to eye about Adam, but you didn't get all up in Rocco's grill when he asked you the best fertilizer for a cannabis crop." "If he'd been stoned on the job, I would have," Mary insists. "You may not believe this, but I don't think you're immoral for sleeping with Adam. In fact, I think it bothers you deep down just as much as it bothers me. And maybe that's why it's taking over your life in a way that's affecting your work." I start to laugh. "Yeah, I'm obsessed with a man. He just happens to be a nonagenarian." Suddenly, an idea lights in my mind, delicate as a beating butterfly. What if I told her? What if this burden I've been carrying around, this confession from Joseph, wasn't only mine to bear? Okay, maybe I have been a little upset. But it's not Adam. It's Joseph Weber. I look her in the eye. I learned something about him, something terrible. He's a Nazi, Mary. Joseph Weber. The same Joseph Weber I know? The one who always leaves a 25% tip and who gives half his roll to his dog? The Joseph Weber who was given the Good Samaritan Award last year by the Chamber of Commerce? Mary shakes her head. This is exactly what I'm talking about, Sage. You're overtired. Your brain is firing on the wrong cylinders. Joseph Weber's a sweet old man I've known for a decade. If he's a Nazi, honey, then I'm Lady Gaga. But Mary, have you told anyone else about this? Immediately, I think of Leo Stein. No, I lie. Well, good, because I don't think there's a novena for slander. I feel as if the whole world is looking through the wrong end of the telescope, and I am the only one who can see clearly. I'm not accusing Joseph, I say desperately. He told me. Mary purses her lips. A few years ago, some scholars translated an ancient text they believed was the Gospel of Judas. They said the information told from Judas's point of view would turn Christianity on its ear. Instead of Judas being the world's biggest traitor, he was apparently the only one Jesus trusted to get the job done, which is why Jesus, knowing he would have to die, picked Judas to confide in. So you believe me? No, Mary says flatly. I don't. And I didn't believe those scholars either. Because I've got 2,000 years of history telling me Jesus, who, incidentally, was one of the good guys sage, just like Joseph Weber, was betrayed by Judas. History's not always right. But you've got to start there anyway. If you don't know where you've come from, how in heaven's name will you ever figure out where you're going? Mary folds me into an embrace. I am doing this because I love you. Go home. Sleep for a week. Get a massage. Hike up a mountain. Clear your head. And then come back. Your kitchen will be waiting for you. I feel dangerously close to sobbing. Please, I beg. Don't take this away from me. It's the only thing in my life I haven't screwed up. I'm not taking anything away from you. It's still your bread. I made Clark promise that he'll use your recipes. What I'm thinking about, though, is the scoring. Back in the days of communal ovens, people would bring their own dough from home to bake en masse with the rest of the village. So how could you tell the loaves apart when they came out of the oven? The way they were cut by the individual bakers. When you score the outside of the dough, it does two things. It tells the loaf where to open, and helps the interior structure by giving it a place to expand. But it also allows the baker to leave his or her brand. I always score a baguette 5 times, for example, with the longest cut at one end. Clark won't. It's a silly thing, one that our customers probably don't even notice, but it's my signature. It's my stamp on each loaf. As Mary walks down the holy stairs, I wonder if this is yet another reason Joseph Weber picked me as his confessor. If you hide long enough, a ghost among men, you might disappear forever without anyone noticing. It's human nature to ensure that someone has seen the mark you left behind. I don't know what got into you today, Adam says as I roll off him and stare up at the bedroom ceiling. But I'm sure as hell grateful. I wouldn't call what we just did lovemaking. It was more like trying to crawl beneath Adam's skin, dissolve by osmosis. I wanted to lose myself in him until there was nothing left. I trail my fingers along his ribcage. Do I seem different to you lately? He grins. Yes, especially in the last half hour. But I'm fully in favor of the new you. He glances at his watch. I need to get going. Today, Adam is presiding over a Japanese Buddhist funeral, and he's been doing research to make sure that he gets all the customs just right. 99.9% of the Japanese are cremated, including the deceased he will be taking care of today. Yesterday was the wake. Can't you stay a little longer? I ask him. No, I've got a ton to do, Adam says. I'm terrified I'm going to mess it up. You've cremated hundreds of people, I point out. Yeah, but there's a whole process for the Japanese. Instead of grinding down the bone residue like we usually do, there's a ritual. Family members pick up the bone fragments together with a special pair of chopsticks and put them into the urn. He shrugs. Besides, you need your beauty sleep. You've only got a few hours before it's time to make the donuts again. I draw the covers up to my chin. Actually, I'm taking a few days off work, I say, as if it were my idea all along. Testing new recipes, reevaluating stuff. How's Mary going to keep her bakery open if you're here? I have a guy filling in for me. I reply, again amazed at how smooth a lie feels in my throat and how much of an aftertaste is left behind. Clark. I think he'll do all right. But it also means I get to live like a normal person, with normal hours. So, you know, maybe you'll be able to stay the night. It would be really nice to fall asleep with you. You fall asleep with me all the time, Adam points out. But it's different. He waits until I'm out like a light, and then takes a shower and tiptoes out of the house. What I want is what other people take for granted. The chance to feel the night tighten around us like a noose. To ask, did you set the alarm? To say, remind me that we are running out of toothpaste. To have our time together not be so romantically charged, but instead, just plain boring. I wind my arms around Adam and bury my face in the curve of his neck. Wouldn't it be fun to pretend we're an old married couple? He disengages himself from my embrace. I don't have to pretend, he says, and he gets up from the bed and walks into the bathroom. As if I needed any reminder of that. I wait until I hear the shower running, and then I throw back the covers and wander into the kitchen. I pour myself a glass of orange juice and sit down at my laptop. On the screen is a spreadsheet I'd used to make a poolish when I first came home from the bakery. Just because I'm not working at our daily bread doesn't mean I can't refine my recipes in my own home test kitchen. The poolish is fermenting on the counter. It's got a few more hours to go before it's usable, but the yeast has frothed at the top, like the head on a beer. I close out the spreadsheet and open YouTube in my browser. I am like many 25-year-olds in this country, I imagine. My knowledge of World War II was shaped by high school history classes, my understanding of the Holocaust a combination of assigned readings, Anne Frank's Diary of a Young Girl, and Elie Wiesel's Night. Even knowing that there was a personal connection to my grandmother, or maybe because of that, I tended to view the Holocaust in the abstract, the way I viewed slavery, a series of horrors that had happened a long time ago in a world markedly different from the one I lived in. Yes, those were bad times, but really, what did they have to do with me? I type Nazi concentration camp into the search bar, and my screen floods with thumbnail images of Hitler's pinched face, of a tangle of bodies in a pit, of a room crammed to the rafters with shoes. I pick a video that is a newsreel from 1945, after the liberation. As it loads, I read the comments underneath. The Holocaust was a hoax. Fuck kikes. Fake shit Holocaust was a Jewish lie. My uncle's farm was there, and the Red Cross praised the camp conditions. Read the report. F you Nazi pig. Stop whining and start admitting. I guess the witnesses were liars, too. This is still happening all over the world while we look the other way like the Germans did 70 years ago. We have learned nothing. I click somewhere into the middle of the 57-minute film. I have no idea what camp I am watching, but I see bodies stacked outside the crematoria, so horrific that it's virtually impossible to believe this wasn't just a Hollywood rendering, that these are real people I am seeing, with their bones protruding so clearly you could map the skeleton beneath the skin, that the face with the eye blown out of it belonged to someone who had a wife, a family, another life. Here are the body disposal facilities, the voiceover tells me. Ovens capable of burning more than 100 bodies per day. Here are the litters, used to slide a body inside, the way I use a peel to slip an artisanal loaf into my wood-fired oven. I see a fleeting image of a skeleton inside the cavern of one of the ovens, another of a pile of bone fragments. I see the plaque of the proud furnace manufacturers, Topf und Söhne. I think of Adam's clients, picking the bones of their beloved from the ash. Then I think of my grandmother, and I feel like I'm going to be sick. I want to close my computer, but I cannot make myself do it. Instead, I watch parades of Germans in their Sunday finest being led into the camps, smiling as if they are on holiday. Their faces change, darkening, some even crying, as they are led on the tour of the facility. I watch Weimar businessmen in suits being pressed into service to relocate and rebury the dead. These were the people who might have known what was going on, but didn't admit it to themselves. Or who turned a blind eye so that they wouldn't have to get involved. The kind of person I'd be if I ignored what Joseph has told me. "So," Adam says, walking into the kitchen with his hair still damp from the shower and his tie already knotted. He starts to rub my shoulders. "Same time Wednesday?" I slam my laptop shut. "Maybe," I hear myself reply. "We should take a break." He looks at me.
"A break?"
"Yeah. I need some time alone, I think."
"Didn't you ask me 5 minutes ago to act like we were married?
And didn't you tell me 5 minutes ago you already are?" I consider what Mary said about how being with Adam might bother me more than I want to admit. I think about being the kind of person who stands up for what she believes in instead of denying what's right before her eyes. Adam looks stunned, but he quickly smooths away the surprise.
"Take as much time as you need, baby."
He kisses me so gently that it feels like a promise, like a prayer.
"Just remember," he whispers, "no one else will ever love you like I do."
It strikes me, as Adam leaves, that his words could be taken as a vow or as a threat. I suddenly remember a girl in my world religion class in college, a foreign student from Osaka. When we were covering Buddhism, she talked about corruption, how much money her family had to pay a priest for her dead grandfather's kaimyo, a special name given to the deceased that he would take with him to heaven. The more you paid, the more characters were in your posthumous name, and the more prestige your family accrued.
"Do you think that matters in the Buddhist afterlife?" the professor had asked.
"Probably not," the girl had said. "But it keeps you from coming back to this world every time your name is called." In retrospect, I realize I should have shared this anecdote with Adam. Anonymity, I guess, always comes at a price. When the phone rings, I'm having a nightmare. Mary is